ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 16th of July. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. A groundbreaking study into Australia's childcare sector has found educators are working an alarming number of unpaid hours. The researchers found these carers have so many additional duties that it takes away from their prime role of supervising children, that kids could be at risk. National Education and Parenting reporter Connor Duffy has the story.
Lesson planning, report writing, cleaning up, even taking out the garbage. Ying Zhao Zhu is a childcare veteran and knows just how much workers have on their plates.
To be very honest, doing all of those things in a day and over, you know, like over the weeks, it's pretty hard.
And that's before workers get to the most important task, caring for children.
Sometimes the days are gone by so fast and so, you know, like so busy that educators sometimes forget to, you know, drink water themselves.
An Australia First study of 570 childcare workers has found educators have what's been described as an alarming number of duties, with more than 70% working an average of 7 to 9 unpaid hours every week. Report author Dr. Erin Harper from the University of Sydney says educators spend just 2.5 quality hours a day with children.
These are not just babysitters, they are qualified educators and degree qualified teachers. If our educators and teachers were truly respected as experts in early childhood education and care, their time with children and their time to focus on education-based work would be protected far more than it currently is.
Carolyn Smith from the United Workers Union says workers aren't getting paid for the extra hours or duties they complete.
Educators are being exploited for the care that they have for the children that they're caring and educating.
The findings have prompted calls for a stocktake of educators' duties amid mounting child safety concerns across the sector. The union saying workers should be free to concentrate on their central role of caring for children.
It's impacting educators, it's impacting children, and it's certainly impacting quality and safety of care.
In a statement, the Minister for Early Childhood Education, Senator Jess Walsh, says the findings are troubling, but that vacancies had been falling since the government moved to fund a 15% pay rise. But Erin Harper fears that without reform, the sector will continue to struggle to retain workers, even with recent wage rises.
If things continue in the sector the way that they are, we are going to continue to see burnout. We are going to continue to see attrition in the sector.
That's report author Dr. Erin Harper and Connor Duffy with the story there. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese had an intense day of meetings in Beijing yesterday with China's most powerful leaders, including President Xi Jinping and Premier Li Qiang. While the focus of the meetings and the way they're reported is often purely on the bilateral relationship, the global trade war set off by US President Donald Trump and the strategic competition between China and America and the region gave this particular meeting a much more complex flavour. The ABC's global affairs editor, Laura Tingle, is travelling with the Prime Minister, and I spoke with her a short time ago. Laura, there are many bilateral pressures in the China-Australia relationship on both the national security and economic fronts, but tell us a little about what the talks yesterday revealed about China's current approach to the world.
Sabra, it really approached that China is trying to appear to be the grown-up in the room amid the global trade war started by Donald Trump. As you say, a lot of bilateral tensions, they weren't ignored completely by either side, but certainly China wasn't emphasising anything particularly contentious like the Port of Darwin, except in the most veiled terms, either in the conversations that the Prime Minister had with President Xi Jinping or with his own counterpart, the Premier. And I think that sort of just shows that in these sorts of meetings, which are so much about setting the sort of public tone of the relationship at any point in time, the focus on the economic relationship is about China not only wanting to be the grown-up in the room, but also showing that it can have good relationships with people in a what's going to be a bit of a tit-for-tat, I think, growing over the next couple of years about who's on whose side in the possible formation of trade blocks between China and the United States.
The Chinese are trying to promote a reputation of being a relatively stable economic partner, in contrast to the United States. but its aggressive military presence is still a matter of concern for Australia and the region. How did the Prime Minister deal with those issues during his meetings with the Chinese President and Premier?
Well, the Prime Minister told us that he had directly raised the question, for example, of the Chinese Navy, for a shorthand term of it, its circumnavigation of Australia and the live fire exercise. Now, the Prime Minister has always said that those actions were all within international law, but obviously Australia was somewhat displeased and alarmed about the fact that they hadn't been alerted to them. So he pressed the point that this was something of an irritant to the Australian government and was sure that this wouldn't happen again. President Xi didn't directly address that, which has been seen as a brush off. He said that China would continue to pursue its interests as Australia would, and which was obviously a reference to the fact that we also press our interests in the South China Sea. So issues like that were addressed, but in the choreography of these meetings, it wasn't, shall we say, a fiery exchange.
Laura Tingle there. US President Donald Trump is facing a backlash from his supporters over the investigation into dead convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. During his run for the presidency, Mr. Trump promised to declassify the so-called Epstein files with all the details about investigations into Epstein and his rumoured list of clients. And the Justice Department last week said there was no such list, but his supporters and even his own daughter-in-law say that the White House needs to show more transparency in its handling of the investigation. North America correspondent Lauren Day reports.
5 years after convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein died in a prison cell, his death is back in the headlines and haunting the Trump administration.
Nothing about Epstein. I'm not going to talk about Epstein.
Attorney General Pam Bondi was one of a number of officials, including FBI Director Kash Patel, who, before the election, repeatedly promised to release documents from the Epstein investigation, including his much-hyped client list. Earlier this year, the Attorney General suggested that was imminent.
It's sitting on my desk right now to review. That's been a directive by President Trump.
Now they've backtracked on the promise, the Justice Department announcing it found no evidence of a client list and reiterating that the disgraced financier died by suicide in his prison cell in 2019.
Are you still talking about Jeffrey Epstein? This guy's been talked about for years. And are people still talking about this guy, this creep?
The turnaround has caused yet another rift in the MAGA movement, including backlash from high-profile figures like Steve Bannon, Tucker Carlson, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and even Donald Trump's own daughter-in-law, Lara Trump. It's also raised questions about the president's own knowledge or involvement in the scandal involving his one-time friend, with billionaire Elon Musk claiming Donald Trump was named in the Epstein files in a tweet he's since deleted.
What did she tell you about the review, and specifically, did she tell you at all that your name appeared in the file?
He's given us just a very quick briefing, and in terms of the credibility of the different things that they've seen, and I would say that, you know, these files were made up by Comey.
The Democrats have now also jumped on the bandwagon, highlighting Donald Trump's prior interactions with Jeffrey Epstein. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries says the American people deserve to know the truth.
This was a conspiracy that Donald Trump, Pam Bondi, and these MAGA extremists have been fanning the flames of for the last several years. And now the chickens are coming home to roost. Option one, they lied for years. Option two, they're engaging in a cover-up.
Republican lawmakers have blocked a Democratic effort to force the release of the Epstein files, but a new poll by CNN found only 3% of people are satisfied with the information released by the federal government in the case so far. Dismissing the controversy over the weekend, Donald Trump described Jeffrey Epstein as a guy who never dies. He's now hoping the story many within his administration once stoked soon will. This is Lauren Day in Washington reporting for AM.
In Adelaide, Aboriginal elders say an inmate at a high security prison's attempted to take his own life 3 times during nearly 800 consecutive days in solitary confinement. In Australia, there are no limits on solitary confinement, and advocates say it's hitting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander prisoners the hardest. Angus Randall reports.
Robert Barnes entered solitary confinement more than 2 years ago at Adelaide's Yatala Prison. Some of the 39-year-old's only interaction with other people has been to receive medical attention after three attempts to end his life while in isolation. Major Mugi Sumner is a Nurrungeri and Kaurna elder and friend of the family.
He's been there for nearly 800 days, locked up in a cell no bigger than a bathroom. And there's nothing in there for him for entertainment. He's suffering, mentally and physically.
Robert Barnes' most recent suicide attempt was yesterday. He's serving an 11-year sentence for multiple assaults, including attacking prison officers. Mr. Sumner says Barnes has been denied cultural support while in the maximum security wing at Yatala Prison in Adelaide's northeast.
You feel like you're nothing. You got no reason for being here.
Melanie Turner was an Aboriginal liaison officer with South Australia's Department for Correctional Services until recently. She resigned in disgust, saying she'd been banned from visiting prisoners in the maximum security G Division.
And when I started advocating for Uncle Mugi to come in, they banned me from going to G Division. And that's my job. Like, I'm an Aboriginal liaison officer, and that's my role to prevent Aboriginal deaths in custody, and they banned me from going there.
In Australia, there are no legal limits to solitary confinement, which is defined by the United Nations as more than 22 hours a day without meaningful human contact. The UN's non-binding rules on the treatment of prisoners say solitary confinement for more than 15 days in a row is a form of torture. Andrea Lax is a Quentin Bryce Scholar at the University of Technology, Sydney, and a former lawyer for Victoria Legal Aid. She says one challenge for those campaigning for regulation is there's no official definition in Australia of solitary confinement.
So you'll see a whole raft of other terms being used: isolation, separation, segregation, timeout. That has a different definition across all states and territories. The sorts of protections in place vary as well in terms of whether you have time out of cell. Does time out of cell look like being able to speak to other people? Does it look like being in fresh air? Do you get to participate in meaningful activities? Do you have meaningful conversations? So all of that is sort of undefined.
The Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody in 1991 found solitary confinement has a particularly detrimental impact on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. South Australia's Department for Correctional Services says it's invited Major Sumner to meet with Yatala's Aboriginal Cultural Treatment Unit next week. It says it's unable to comment on individual prisoners.
Angus Randall and Luke Radford reporting there. And if this story is raised issues for you and distress, you can call the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Crisis Support Line 13 Yarn. That's 13 92 76. Fancy a new architect-designed home for just $1? Well, the plans, at least. New South Wales residents are being offered that deal as part of a state government program tackling the housing crisis. A so-called pattern book of low-rise home designs will allow property owners to access a pre-approved government home designs in what's being promised as a way to reduce red tape and costs and speed up the delivery of new homes. Miles Holbrook-Walk reports.
New South Wales may be home to some of the nation's most expensive real estate, but the state government believes it's come up with a better blueprint for slashing the cost and approval time for new housing. Paul Scully is the planning minister for New South Wales.
The government architect has endorsed 8 terrace townhouse and manor house designs that will be available for $1,000 per design for all the technical drawings. But for the first 6 months, the government is significantly subsidising access to these, making them available to everyone for a dollar.
Paul Scully wants people to take a chance on these 8 approved designs for low-rise homes. For the next 6 months, they're being offered to those wanting to build a new home at the cut price rate of $1.
Well, we'll see how successful it is over the next 6 months, but we're confident people, when they see these designs, they'll say, this is the sort of stuff that we want to see in streets and suburbs near us. A discounted price of $1 per pattern, saving nearly $20,000 over the cost of a custom architecturally designed home, and they'll be looking to get on with that task.
Harry Katerns is a partner from Saha Architects, one of the companies which designed one of the new patterns. He explains how it works.
So the pattern book is a state initiative to try to improve affordability and accessibility of good design. And so the government has released a set of pre-designed patterns for terraces, semis, manor houses and townhouses, with the idea that they're available to the public for a low price. And if the public chooses to use them, they can achieve a kind of streamlined approval process.
But he concedes the patents won't work for everyone.
Well, I guess there's a lack of flexibility, you know, for people in some degree because they're using a patent. So there might be specific sites that a patent won't work on. And also there's a degree to which you're stuck with what the architect has decided upon. So, you know, it might not suit everyone, but I think it's a pretty great opportunity for a lot of people.
All over the country, the challenges of housing affordability goes well beyond the cost of designing a home. So even if this scheme proved popular, supply will remain a stubborn issue. Data released earlier this month from Cotality shows the cost of a home reached a new national peak, and that in every capital city, homes are more expensive than they were a year ago. This week, the ABC revealed that Treasury advised the federal government that its 1.2 million homes target would also not be met. Each state and territory government has their own local targets, and when asked if New South Wales was on track to meet theirs, Paul Scully was coy.
We remain determined to meet that housing target. There's some challenging macroeconomic conditions that we have to face with interest rates higher than what we'd like to see. But the government continues to make the planning reforms, to make the investment in social housing, to look at where its land could be used for housing.
That's New South Wales Planning Minister Paul Scully, and in that report from Miles Holbrook-Walk and Nicole Johnston. In many states, GPs are getting new powers to diagnose attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and prescribe drugs. It's hoped that will ease the burden on specialist doctors. Isabel Massali reports.
A decision that'll soon allow GPs in South Australia to diagnose attention deficit hyperactivity disorder didn't just make news. It made people's day.
I had patients texting me the articles. Did you see this? This is so awesome.
Naomi Rutten is a GP in the SA town of Gawler and the president of the Australian Society for Psychological Medicine. ADHD is also personal for her. She was diagnosed as an adult.
I've got like half a dozen patients who can't afford the assessment that see me regularly. So now, like, we're super, super excited. They'll be able to, you know, trial some medication, and if it helps improve their function, then that is going to make the world of difference.
For a long time, diagnosis has largely been restricted to psychiatrists and paediatricians. But SA, WA and New South Wales have recently announced they're changing that. And in Tasmania, there's bipartisan support ahead of this weekend's election. Dr. Rutten warns there'll still be an out-of-pocket cost for most patients.
The government Medicare rebates for longer appointments do not match the cost of running things.
ADHD Foundation Director Christopher Wiesman.
There should be some formalised structures in place to prevent the general public from being overcharged, and certainly to ensure that the GPs are properly incentivised.
Dr. Tim Jones is with the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. He believes the changes will lead to better long-term care for patients and reduce inequity in accessing support, but wants more to be done.
If we're talking about the equity gap, the only way I can see that fully getting addressed is if we've got more GPs working in those collaborative partnerships in public healthcare services.
And as shortages for some ADHD medications continue, will these changes push up demand?
What we saw in Queensland when GPs were enabled to take on some diagnosis and prescribing for children was that the numbers of kids being diagnosed didn't rapidly increase. It was far more an initiative to improve access.
But not every person who has the disorder will need medication, or it may be used short term. Dr. Jones says it's too soon to know if there's an over-reliance among Australian adults.
There are so many of those fair stories coming out about people who found going on medication incredibly helpful. But what we need to be getting out there is an equally important message, is that medication can never be the only answer.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the Federal Department of Health said ministers from across the country will discuss options to achieve national harmonisation of ADHD prescribing practices at their next meeting.
Isabel Massali reporting there with Kate O'Halloran. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Will Australia join a US war against China if it invades Taiwan? That's the stark question Anthony Albanese faced during his delicate visit to Beijing, where he's trying to strengthen trade and business ties. Today, the ABC's newly appointed Global Affairs Editor, Laura Tingle, joins us from Beijing. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.